And I would tell someone, oh, I'm from Palestine. Said, oh, is that, do you mean Israel? Or where is that? And people wouldn't know. And I was in shock because in my head, how could you not know where Palestine is? Given what's going on, surely everyone will know.
This is Writer's Mosaic in Conversation. John Sadiq talks to Basma Galioni about her journey from working in IT to editing the anthologies Palestine 100 and Palestine Minus One.
Hi Basma, thank you for welcoming into your home and it's just really lovely to be here with you. You've edited this really beautiful book, Palestine Minus One, recently, and it's interesting, a couple of days we're recording and it's just a couple of days before Nakba Day. It's a rainy day in Manchester, indeed. And it'd be really lovely to talk to you about your sort of artistic journey and journey as an editor and putting this book together. And because we're going to kind of center on this book, I'd really love it if you would kind of just share a little bit of the intro with me for our listeners so that we can kind of get a feeling for it.
Yes, thank you for having me. And any chance really to talk about Palestine for me. So I'll start with a bit of a read. Through 77 years of occupation, violence, displacement and repeated collective punishment, Palestinians have never stopped running. Not just from the soldiers on their streets, the drones and the F-35s in their skies, the warships in their seas, the informants in their midst, or the world's most technologically advanced, politically impervious military state bearing down on all sides, but from an idea, a century-old myth, a fantasy, that you can spread a map out on a table somewhere and simply invent a country, regardless of what already exists there. It's a European fantasy, of course. This particular one being the brainchild of Theodor Herzl, an atheist Jewish journalist from Budapest, who sought to heal the wound of anti-Semitism in Europe by creating a completely new Jewish homeland. Through a lifetime of lobbying and organizing, Herzl put various proposals for such a state, including Lord Chamberlain's later abandoned Uganda scheme, onto the European political agenda. That is to say, onto politicians' tables. Herzl wasn't the only European to indulge in tabletop fantasies, of course. In late 1915, when British and French diplomats Mark Sykes and François-Georges Picot sat down at tables in London and Paris and secretly drew straight lines to lands that didn't belong to them, and through lives that they would never know, dividing the spoils of the Ottoman Empire between three other empires. They too were indulging in a fantasy, one that would soon, if briefly, cohere with Herzl's. The new British colony of Mandatory Palestine would need partners on the ground, proxies, to eventually take the dirty work. And 2 years after the Sykes-Picot Agreement was ratified, the British found their proxy, their co-fantasists in the Zionists. When Lord Balfour scribbled his famous 1917 declaration, a document with no legal or moral basis, greenlighting the creation of a new country for a community at that time that only made up 5% of the population on the ground, it was yet another exercise in fantasy world building.
Thank you so much. I just want to thank you for this intro, quite honestly. I was reading it and just thought, you know, with the level of obscuration that goes on around Palestine, how great it was to actually have something short, like a Cliff Notes version of the history, basically. Mm-hmm. And just what an amazing piece of work the intro is on its own, as well as introducing us to the authors in the book. It was just such a refreshing thing to read, because you try to find out how things have come to be, and unless you actually really work at it, it's very, very difficult. Most people don't get access or have the time or the maybe even in the inclination to find out, you know, where things have come from. We live in a very kind of shallow world these days where people don't dig any deeper very much, I feel sometimes. And so it was just a wonderful intro. And I love this tabletop fantasies of world building concept. Where did that come from for you? How did that image come up?
It starts with the way the book started, really. Just before the genocide, me and the series editor, Ra Pager, and we're discussing what our next book could be after Palestine Plus 100, which Palestine Plus 100 was set in the future. And we thought it would be good to have 10 Palestinian writers talk about the village they came from through a horror story and and build a world around that village that they came from through the lens of horror, really. And that's really where the idea came from, just world building, which we did touch upon in Palestine Plus 100 and wanted to continue to do so in Palestine Minus 1. So each village in the book, each writer in the book talks about their village through a world that they created in that story.
And it's just such an effective thing. I was just so surprised, actually. And I wanted to talk about the book a bit later and talk about your journey first, but we've started on the book first, so we'll do that. That's okay. It's absolutely fantastic. And then we'll look at your journey, as it were. I think there's 12 authors in the book, isn't there, it ends up with. And besides horror, what really surprised me is that we also have mythological, magic realism, and sort of fantasy and horror, and that kind of almost that eschewing of the documentary in a way, yet there's still no way to avoid what one is talking about, you know. And one or two of the stories, you know, I found very, anything around Palestine is very difficult to take in, especially if you're a global majority person from an country that had been occupied or colonized or and so on. So like, for example, there's a story based on the murder, the killing, the slaughter of Hind Rajab and her family.
Yeah.
And that was such a difficult...
Trapped, yes, by unlocked hands.
Yeah, such a difficult thing. And yet there's this kind of time-shifting thing that the author does, which is really quite incredible.
Yeah.
Actually, could you sort of share with us a little bit about those kind of approaches within the book?
This particular story, Anwar Hamid wrote in the previous book, Palestine Plus 100, it was meant to be science fiction, but it ended up being slightly horror in the previous story, in the previous book. With this one, we thought we'd ask him to write for us again, because he's from the West Bank, and he has a very deep knowledge on Palestine. So he was born and lived in the West Bank, moved to the UK, and he wrote about the village of Tantoura, where there was a massive massacre that occurred. It was horrendous, and one of the massacres that not very much spoken about, like other massacres. It was on the sea. Towards the end of it, the men in the village were made to bury their own dead in the sand, and it was just absolutely horrendous. So what he did was he did a time-shifting thing, or I think it was more a metamorphosis thing. So we've got one character who moves within bodies of her ancestors. So she first starts as a little girl, and then in the 2023 current time, and then she moves again to the 90s in her mother's body, then her grandmother's body, who witnessed the Tantoura massacre. And what he did was he's just facing the demons of the past in a way. You have to, obviously, I don't want to spoil it, but the time shifting element for me, I found pretty. I actually was in tears reading this story when it first came in, and because of the power, how powerful Hind Rajab's story was, he goes into vivid detail about that particular scene, but also going back, and there's a theme throughout the story with the hair braids. I mean, that story is quite haunting, really.
Yeah, it's incredible. Absolutely incredible. Yeah. And there's another one that really stuck out for me, which is I Swear This All Happened by Liane Bader.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this is kind of, that we have a duplicate in the underworld.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we're in kind of like the mythic and the sort of symbolic way of storytelling. Absolutely absolutely incredible.
Liane touched on a bit of folklore, Palestinian or Arab folklore, where it's said that every person has a duplicate who makes them do bad things. And she touched upon this in a very clever way, because she also mentioned a school of girls who are all orphaned girls from the massacre of Deir Yassin. And they're all in a school, and they're all discussing this potential existence of a ghoul or a duplicate that makes you do bad things. She uses it in the context of every Palestinian village being erased and then turned into an Israeli village or an Israeli town, and that kind of being some kind of form of duplicate. Also wondering if the Israelis have duplicate or the IDF have duplicates that make them do those bad things. So she used it on many levels, and but she also talked about the massacre of Deir Yassin and all the bigger context of the orphans who were in those schools. So she touched upon a lot of subjects. And then the bigger context of the diaspora, because her story spans, again, over a few years, because first they're students at school, and then as grown-ups, they're all scattered into different areas in the Arab world, and they meet up and talk about it. So yeah, she used that theme, and it was, again, quite haunting.
Yeah, and then there's the stories with dragons. Dragons pop up a few times as well. And I found that really interesting too, that this dragon theme comes. There's one story that's specifically about dragons. There's another story where it kind of opens with this image of these dragons. It made me, I got to thinking, you know, if I was to give this interview with you a title, I was going to call it something like The Art of Editing the Impossible. and if, I guess if we were to sit down with this group of beautiful writers, it's the art of writing the impossible. Mm. Can't imagine the commission coming, you know, can you write a piece about sort of Palestine, how you'd even tackle that. So to take this sort of speculative fiction, for want of better words, approach to it, just seemed to be a very wise way to take this on.
Yeah. I tell you, I was very surprised as to how, surprised and also not surprised, because Palestine for us as Palestinians is very close to the surface. It's on the surface, you know, it's just there. So you ask someone, a writer, to write about Palestine, it will happen very quickly, very naturally, because that's all we ever think about. That's what we are. It runs in our veins, you know. Our identity is we are Palestinian, and that's all we think about all the time. And we apply our work with our children, our homes. So as writers, I was surprised, but also not surprised as to how, surprised because like you said, the genre was a bit different to what they're used to, but not surprised because they're Palestinians and it just came, it just flowed. There was very little editing involved in the stories. I mean, they all came very ready and well written and to the point. So there's that element of things, but also with the genre, it also helps process, you know, that each of those writers will be writing from personal experience. So they'll all be processing their identity and processing their relationship with Palestine. And so the writing would have been a kind of like a balm, like just a way for them to process their own lives and relationship with Palestine and being Palestinian.
Does the mythic kind of, the mythic or the, I don't want to say speculative, but the kind of mythic and poetic, seems, is that then very much in the Palestinian literary blood?
Yeah, we have a very rich folklore and very rich tapestry, as it were, of fables and stories that our grandmothers would tell us about certain things that would happen if, I don't know, if you ate too fast, or if or what happened to certain villagers in certain places in Gaza. There's loads of folklore, and they use that to write those stories. One of the things that me personally doesn't bother me, it's just I wish it was different, is that there's a lot of heavy associations between Palestine, the Palestinian cause, and religion, Islam, the Islamic religion, and that kind of overshadows a lot of other elements of Palestinian community and the Palestinian culture, which is this kind of culture, the peasant culture or the city culture, the Christian culture. There are all those other elements of our lives that are not talked about, and one of them being we do have our own superstitions and our stories and all those, you know, things that happen on a daily life that aren't related to religion. And I thought this book was a good way to highlight that.
I think we need more of this, quite honestly. I mean, I really think we need more of this, and I really want your book to be much more seen, especially when you see a title like Palestine Minus One and you think, God, this is going to be hard going, you know?
Yeah.
And it is hard going, but not in the way you think it is, because that weaving of myth and the jinn story, yeah, and the shadow world and the mythic, it kind of gives everybody 3D again. It takes you out of what the news presents us. Yeah. and gives life back.
Yeah, it shows all the elements that make us who we are. Just like there are other elements in other communities, there are massive, a lot of elements in Palestinian communities and Palestinian people that make us who we are. And like you said, there, it's very one-dimensional what we think a Palestinian is or Palestine is. And these books help, like you said, turn the people into people that are relatable, or not even relatable, just it gives them all other elements that, of who they are.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's quite amazing, that kind of reductive property of propaganda, yeah. as it were. As a child, I travelled with my father and my whole family, actually. We travelled right the way across the East. And, you know, I can remember being a child in Iran and Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah.
And then I see representations of it on the news, and my child self is like, no, no, that's not what it's like.
Yeah.
You know?
That's great.
And so this, to me, was like a kind of a drink of water, quite honestly, after that kind of sort of desert of propaganda. So yeah. Absolutely fantastic. So I wanted to ask you about your own journey, becoming an editor, and your own creative journey. So I'd love it if you'd share with us what your journey has been with becoming an editor and translator.
Yeah, I don't get to talk about this much, actually. It did happen. It wasn't something I set off to be. It happened by, I'd say, maybe coincidence. I mean, I could...
What did you set off to be?
Well, so I was born in Palestine, lived in Gaza until I was 26, 27. And at university, I did software engineering. And then I came to the UK to do a further studies on, you know, system management, all things that nothing to do with art or nothing to do with literature. But because I spoke both languages, I would do quite a bit of translation just on the side, or to make a bit of money. And that was my door. Now, that coincided with me coming to the UK and being in complete shock of how little people knew about Palestine. See, I came from Gaza, and when I arrived, I thought, okay, I'll just tell people I'm from Palestine. They'll know exactly what I'm talking about. Who doesn't know Palestine? And I would tell someone, oh, I'm from Palestine. Say, oh, is that, do you mean Israel? Oh, where is that? And people would know. And I was in shock, because in my head, how could you not know where Palestine is? Given what's going on, surely everyone will know. So it was quite a steep learning curve for me, that I had to explain to people what was going on, and then realizing how misrepresentative the news was. I started doing freelance translation, and some of it happened to be with Comma. I met Ra through one of the writers of Book of Gaza, and then I started working for Comma on a freelance basis, after which Comma Press were doing a series called the Plus 100, the first one being Iraq Plus 100. And then me and him just thought, wouldn't it be a good idea to do Palestine Plus 100? And who can edit it? I thought I'd edit it, because we just had a lot to think about, a lot to talk about. And I had a lot, I was so frustrated. I took out so much in that intro, because I thought, how do people not know this? Nobody ever asks why when it comes to Palestine. Nobody ever asks why. They see what's going on now. No one's ever, I meet a lot of people, no one's ever sat down with me or come to me and said, can you please tell us more? Explain this, explain that. Nobody, I don't know if people are shy or if they feel awkward around me. I don't understand, but I wish someone would just, I obviously encourage people to do their own research as well, but all the information is just so biased and geared toward the pro-Israel and the Zionist narrative. I just want someone to sit down and say, so tell us why this particular thing happens. Tell us why these particular resistance groups exist. What are they resisting against? Why did all this come to be? Nobody ever asked. So I thought it would be a good idea in that book, in Palestine Plus 100, to take that all out in the intro, and also the stories would help give context. And that was how my first editing role came to be. I also do a lot of work on the Arabic titles within Comma. That's a whole other element of my job, yeah.
And what do you see the kind of the key elements of being an editor to be?
In my experience with those two books, my role was, there was a big translation role, because a lot of the stories came in Arabic and were translated to English. So I would look over the translations, make sure none of the idioms are lost and the nuances of the language and the accents, because a lot of writers would write in the colloquial native accent that they, from whatever village they came from. So I'd oversee that. Also, the context, like I would find most of the writers, I'd find them, and communicating with them and just making sure that a lot of the elements of Palestine and being Palestinian existed in the stories, and they covered a lot of concepts that as a Palestinian I'd like to be covered. So for example, with Palestine Plus 100, the series editor, who was Ra, oversaw a lot of the science fiction elements, which are not my strong suit.
Right.
I was more the Palestinian element of the book. Same with this one. In terms of the genre, the horror of it, Ra would oversee the horror element and kind of where all of those elements fell within a story. I oversaw the Palestine element because I'm just so passionate about, like you said, a Palestinian book being out there that's not about religion and or Hamas or any of the other things. It's just about being a Palestinian, everyone's unique experience and their relationship with Palestine. I was driving down, I don't know, I think the Mancunian Way the other day, and there's a building being demolished, one of the Manchester Metropolitan University buildings, and my son looked out the window and said, "Oh, look, it looks like Gaza." And I thought, even my son's association, who he visited Gaza in 2022 and knows how beautiful it is and the beaches, now even he has this association of rubble. Oh, look, must be something from Gaza. And that association, obviously it is happening, but it's not all that Palestine or Gaza is. It's not, and it's not what I want people to think, to associate Palestinians with, because then it's much more than that. And there's this whole element of idealization that I'm not saying I'm offended by it, I just wish it would be different. You know, Palestinians, they're not heroes, they're not angels, they're just humans,
yeah.
You know? They're flawed, massively flawed. Like when I don't know, let's say some looting happens in Gaza post-genocide, we're like, oh my God, how can Gazans do this? It's a country being occupied. People need to survive somehow. There's a lot of it. Why are you all surprised? We're only human. We're all flawed.
Well, people are denied the right to be people. We're denied the right to be human beings, aren't we, by this unspoken rule of kind of purity, kind of culture, I suppose, 100. Which has really infected our kind of modern time, that you have to be worthy of compassion, you know, because you're pure
100%.
In some way that somebody's projecting on you.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
I 100% agree. And if any other people were subjected to the same oppression, let's say the English, you know, had some, I don't know, flaw in their queuing system, I'm sure they will react the same way. They'll revolt. Do you know what I mean? If you're subjected to pressure and occupation, you will fight back. You will.
Absolutely. Where do you see your editing journey sort of heading, or you through your work heading? Where do you want to go with this? Do you have a kind of a sense of your journey moving forward now? Or is this kind of occupying a lot of your kind of
space? The editing journey has been a learning curve for me as well. Like I said, like with both intros, I had to do a lot of research, and I learned so much about my own history doing them. And I would hope that there would be more books to come out, but the way that both those books have worked is they've been a reaction to something. This one definitely, even though the seed of it happened before the genocide kind of helped it just kind of, you know, happen. And I feel, I don't want this to be the end of it. There's no plans at the moment for me as an editor. There are more Palestine books. There's one more Palestinian book coming out with Comma soon, but I'm not editing it. My work with Comma is to oversee Palestinian projects and Arabic projects, so I will be kind of involved in them. But I don't see any. There's nothing in the pipeline for me at the moment as an editor. But I hope this is not the end of it.
In one of the stories, it may be the one that's like the analog of the Hind Rajab story. Somebody asked somebody else, how dare you get married while all this is going on?
Yeah.
Why don't we just wait a few more days?
Yeah.
And reading that made me realise how important it is to get married, even though I won't give anything away about the story.
Yeah.
I'm reading that and I'm thinking to myself, even if you're only married for one day, you have to be married.
Yeah.
Even if you you know, you have to have your children, you have to get married, you have to have family, you have to do the human things.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Otherwise, you're stripped of everything,
I mean,
aren't you?
People are getting married in the displacement camps. Yeah. In the First Intifada, which is where when I was a child and teenager, people would get married, there'd be strikes and curfews, and people would get married in their flats, you know, they'd everyone would kind of sneak into the house and they'd have a quick party and that's it, they're married. Not to sound like a cliche, but existence is resistance in a way in that context, you know? And you just have to keep going. And marriage, Palestinians, they find a way to just, because we're so used to all of this, we find a way to keep going, you know? We find a way to keep going because otherwise we'll never do anything because we're continually being bombed and occupied. There's curfews, there's strikes. We can't just stop every time something like this happens or we'll never do anything. Mm. I used to get bombed at night and go to uni and have a, you know, whatever, a calculus exam in the morning and just nothing. It's just how
you have to live.
You have to. You just find a way to cope. It shouldn't be the way. This shouldn't be an excuse for people to say, well, yeah, fine, Palestinians can deal with it. But that is what we do.
Mm. Absolutely. One of the stories says you can only be killed once. That really struck me, actually. And these kind of ghosts or these spirits are kind of pushing forward and like, well, we can only die once, you know, and we're dead already. So yeah, we will live, as it were, you know. And
that's Mazin's story, I think.
Mm, just to close out, because, as you say, there's a lack of knowledge about Palestine. Mm. It just doesn't have to be Palestine now that we're talking about. I'd love it if you would share with us three books that you love.
Three?
Yeah, three books that you love that don't necessarily have to be connected to Palestine, but if you wanted to recommend a Palestinian author and a couple of other authors you love, because I always want to know who to read, what to read.
Yeah, Ahmed Mas'oud, I think, is a very strong writer. He's a Palestinian writer. I enjoy his books. He wrote a book, I think it's called Vanished. There's that one. Suzanne Abulhawa, all her work is just... But I think the most, weirdly, the book I would recommend that for me was just very, very informative contextually and I couldn't put it down was Ellen Pepe's The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. I would highly recommend that book. It's a heavy read, but also not so heavy because you read it and you feel, okay, it's all falling into place now. This all makes sense to me, you know, contextually. So I would recommend that the most. But Suzanne Abulhawa, anything by Suzanne Abulhawa, I think I would highly recommend.
And what about a book or an author for beauty or joy in the face
beauty
of all
this? Beauty or joy?
Yes, because we've just talked about the necessity of living.
I mean, to be honest, I always secretly enjoy reading Roald Dahl. His adult stuff is pretty funny.
I like Roald Dahl.
Yeah,
actually.
His adult stuff is crazy funny.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of controversy around him. I don't know, there my past. I don't know, but Roald Dahl definitely. There's a collection called Switch Bitch that I recently reread, and I think that just takes you away from all the everything. But yeah.
Cool. Thank you so much, Basma. Thank you for talking to us.
And thank you for having me.
Basma Galiani was in conversation with John Sadiq. To hear more writers, go to writersmosaic.org.uk.